From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Political speech involves running for office. It is one of the most preferred uses of the First Amendment. You can challenge, rebut, argue. Please never tell any candidate not to speak.
Today, the Nader Factor. Will he run? We'll ask him. Then, lost legal battles and the long road to justice in America.
Throughout American history, political activists such as the abolitionists, women's rights activists, have gone to court not simply to win victories in court, but to help spur their movements. How can we do that today?
Success without victory. We'll speak with attorney Jules LaBelle, and we'll talk to a man who lost his soldier son in Iraq and went to Iraq.
Yes, we go to the Iraq because I need to find the place my son died and to make the relation with the Iraq people and America people friendly.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court upheld the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law that bans unregulated donations to political parties from wealthy backers, corporations, or unions. The justices also backed provisions of the law that control campaign season political advertising. Voting to uphold the law were Justices John Paul Stevens, Sandra Day O'Connor, David Souter, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Stephen Breyer. They wrote in the majority opinion, quote, "The prevention of corruption or its appearance constitutes a sufficiently important interest to justify political contribution limits." Against the law were Chief Justice William Rehnquist and Justices Antonin Scalia, Anthony Kennedy, and Clarence Thomas. Both the National Rifle Association and the AFL-CIO expressed outrage over the decision. Wayne LaPierre, head of the NRA, said the ruling was, quote, "the most significant change in the First Amendment since the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798, which tried to make it a crime to criticize a member of Congress." The Center for Responsive Politics praised the decision. Its executive director, Larry Noble, said the court, quote, "confirmed what many political actors and observers have known for years, that large political contributions buy access to elected officials and raise the potential for corruption within the political system." Meanwhile, the Public Interest Research Group criticized the court for not going far enough to reform the campaign finance laws. The court upheld a change in the law that increased the amount individuals can give a candidate from $1,000 to $2,000. A day after the Pentagon announced that companies from France, Germany, and Russia would be barred from winning contracts to help build Iraq, President Bush called the leaders of each country to ask them to forgive billions in debt owed by Iraq. A memo from Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz appeared on the Pentagon's website just hours before Bush was scheduled to call the leaders of France, Germany, and Russia and ask them to receive Presidential Envoy James Baker. Baker's traveling to Europe this weekend to ask countries to wipe out Iraq's debt. The White House said President Bush was surprised about the timing and tone of Wolfowitz's directive, which claimed the ban on countries that opposed the invasion was needed in part for security reasons. The Washington Post reports the White House has authorized the CIA to train, finance, and equip a new Iraqi intelligence service. The new agency will spy on the Iraqi resistance movement that opposed the U.S. occupation. Meanwhile, defense officials said Wednesday one-third of the Iraqis who were trained as soldiers by U.S. occupying forces have since quit the new Iraqi army. The U.S. was hoping to quickly form a 700-man Iraqi battalion, but 250 of the soldiers have already quit. The Guardian of London's reporting there are 10,000 private military contractors on the ground in Iraq. Private military companies are now providing more personnel to Iraq than any country besides the U.S. The Army's estimating that of the $87 billion recently approved by Congress to rebuild Iraq and Afghanistan, $30 billion will go to private military companies. A USA Today study has found the U.S. dropped or fired nearly 11,000 cluster bombs or cluster weapons on Iraq during the invasion, and Britain dropped 2,000 more. It's unknown how many Iraqis died from cluster bombs. One estimate put the total at 370 deaths, and the attacks left behind thousands of unexploded bomblets. At least 8 U.S. soldiers and an unknown number of Iraqis have been killed by these unexploded bombs. An acceptance ceremony for the Nobel Peace Prize. Iranian human rights activist Shireen Ebadi warned that the so-called war on terrorism must not erode civil liberties and human rights. Speaking in Persian, she said, quote, "In the past 2 years, some states have violated the universal principles and laws of human rights by using the events of September 11th and the war on international terrorism as a pretext." She continued, "Regulations restricting human rights and basic freedoms have been justified and given legitimacy under the cloak of the war on terrorism." Ebadi is an attorney. She is the first Muslim woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize. In Tel Aviv, at least 3 people have died after an explosion inside a foreign currency exchange booth. Police suspect the bombing was meant to kill Zev Rosenstein, a man believed to be one of Israel's most powerful mobsters. In Gaza, Israeli forces launched its largest incursion into the Rafah refugee camp in 2 months. The BBC reports 4 Palestinians have been killed, 17 more wounded. And in campaign news, the Denis Kucinich campaign is reporting that ABC News has pulled its reporters from covering his campaign, as well as those of Carol Mosley Braun and Reverend Al Sharpton. The decision comes more than a month and a half before the first primary vote is cast. Kucinich said this is an example of, quote, "The media trying to pick candidates rather than letting the voters do so. In a democracy, it should be voters and not pundits or TV networks who narrow the field of candidates," unquote. Alice Coltrane, Rite of Spring, here on Democracy Now! On a very rainy day in New York City. I'm Amy Goodman. We read it in the headlines. A USA Today study has found the U.S. dropped or fired nearly 11,000 cluster bombs or cluster weapons on Iraq during the invasion, and Britain dropped 2,000 more. It's unknown how many Iraqis have died from these bombs. One estimate puts the total around 370. The attacks left behind thousands of unexploded bombs. At least 8 U.S. soldiers and an unknown number of Iraqis have been exploded from the cluster bombs. I'm going to look at the USA Today report right now, read from it, talking about troops from the 101st Airborne finding themselves in Baghdad's al-Jihad neighborhood in mid-April, contending with hundreds of unexploded M42 cluster bomblets. There were M42s all around the houses, says Major Mike Getchell of Bridgewater, Massachusetts, executive officer of the 101st Airborne's 3rd Brigade. During the 3 weeks the 101st troops patrolled al-Jihad, they destroyed an average of 100 M42s every day. On April 19th, Sergeant Troy Jenkins, who was 25, a 6'7" paratrooper from Repton, Alabama, was bringing up the rear of a patrol through the streets of al-Jihad. The streets were packed with people celebrating a festival. Suddenly, a little girl emerged from the crowd carrying what turned out to be an M42 cluster bomblet. She tried to hand it to Jenkins. No one in the patrol knows exactly what happened next, but the bomblet went off and the little girl, Jenkins, and 3 other soldiers went down. The little girl died after her family took her to a hospital. Jenkins was evacuated for medical treatment, first to Kuwait, then to Germany, where he died after losing his left leg. He left behind a wife and 2 sons, ages 4 and 2. The 3 other soldiers recovered. Cluster munitions also may have claimed the life of Lance Corporal Jesus Suarez del Solar, who was 20 years old. The Marine scout from Escondido, California, died on March 27th after stepping on some type of unexploded ordnance while on reconnaissance patrol outside Baghdad. A Marine investigation concluded that the origin of the ordnance is unknown and really impossible to determine. But the dead Marine's father, Fernando Suarez del Solar, has a different account. He says he was contacted by one of his son's friends, who said the Army dropped cluster weapons on March 26th and not all the submunitions exploded. We're joined in the studio right now by Fernando Suarez del Solar, along with Medea Benjamin of Global Exchange. They went to Iraq and have just returned, along with a delegation of families of those who are in Iraq or who've died in Iraq. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
And Medea, if you can help translate, that would be great. Can you talk about your son and what you have found? This is certainly new information. What were you told when you were told your son had died in Iraq?
Yes, the government told me my son is passed away in Iraq when received the shock in the head.
But that he had been shot in the head?
Yes, this is the official report.
That's the official report.
But the few days late in the ABC News, I see the different story. The story is my son stepped the blood cluster bomb, American cluster bomb. And I made investigation myself, and this one is the truth. The last night, 26, the army dropped the cluster bomb in the area, and the next day my son company received the order in advance, but without information, the area have the cluster bomb, American cluster bomb. My son is the scout, and stepped the cluster bomb and make the accident.
Where was this?
27 in the night.
And in what place in Iraq?
Jubania. It's about 110 miles from South Baghdad.
Did you go there?
Yes. When I go to the Iraq, I find the place, exact place. And it's very solitary place, very bad place. But I understand what happened. The military commander not put attention for this situation.
Can you describe what you're wearing around your neck?
This is my son, Doctor, the identification.
His identification?
He had this one when the accident. And my son friends hold for my wife and for me. And I have this one, I never pick it up, because this one is my soul energy with me. This one is very important for me.
We're talking to Fernando Suarez del Solar, who lost his son in Iraq. You've now learned it was a U.S. cluster bomb. What does the U.S. military say?
Well, the military say is make the investigation, and it's impossible exactly what happened, because the military say find the American and the Iraqi cluster bomb, and it's impossible put determination what bomb my son stepped.
That there were both U.S. and Iraqi cluster bombs?
The military official told me this one. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I don't believe it.
What do the other soldiers in the unit say?
Oh, my son friends told me is Jesus is in advance, and it's plopped something when going right away what happened. And looking in the area, is more cluster American bomb in the area unexploded. And I deduce it's only American cluster bomb in the area.
What did your son tell you while he was in Iraq? How long was he there? And did he communicate with you? Did he call? Did he write?
No, my son lived into Iraq the February 5, and I never have any information for him.
And he died on?
27, and I received information early 28 in the morning. Friday, 28:15 in the morning. I never forget the day.
They came to your home?
3 militaries go to my home and say, your son Isairo died in combat last night in Iraq. And ask for the what happened. And the military is the same robot. Your son is a hero, died last night in combat.
Your son is a hero? What did they say, that your son?
Yes, is a hero.
What were his feelings about the invasion and speaking to him before he left?
I feeling very bad inside against the government, Bush, the Bush administration.
You or him?
My son.
Who felt bad about the Bush administration?
Oh, I'm sorry, I understand the first question. Yes, when my son leaving to Iraq, I speak with him, and I try to explain the war is not the way for the solution. But my son told me, Father, I believe you, but it's my job. I am Marine, and I go because it's my job. But remember this one, Father. I go into Iraq not because Bush or somebody say. I go because it's my job, and I'm going to try to help the children in Iraq for to have the best life. My son died, no have opportunity for to help the children, but I am here for try to finish my son's job over there.
And so you travel to Iraq?
Right.
How long were you there? Where did you go? What was it like? Did you speak to Iraqi children?
Yes, I have about the 1 week over there. I go to the school and hospital. I speak with the children in the street, in the school. The children is very happy when you speak with her, or boys or girls. And when you explain, listen, I am American, and my son is dying here in your country, but I love you. Because my son loved the children. The children say, I'm sorry, but thank you for giving me the opportunity, the best place. But the children is very bad in Iraq right now. For example, in the hospital, not have a medicine, is not have a sanitizer institution. And this one is terrific. The children is died because not have attention, is died because not have antibiotics.
Antibiotics.
And I asked, where is the money that Mr. Bush got it from the taxpayer? Where it put this money, $87 billion? Only in the military system? Why not help the victims for the war? And the victims of the war is the children. I see one boy, 12 years old, is blind because the cluster bomb.
Blinded by the cluster bomb?
In the school. It is not military objective, but the school is bombing.
The school was bombed?
Yes. I don't know why. It's the residential area, no military complex around there.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves, and we'll be back with Fernando Suarez del Solar, who lost his son, Lance Corporal Jesus Suarez del Solar. He was 20 years old. We'll also be joined by another man who went to Iraq with Fernando. His son is training to go to the Gulf, and we'll speak with Medea Benjamin, who's been there many times, about comparisons between what is there happening there now and what it looked like in the past. We'll also later be talking with Ralph Nader. Will he run for the presidency? And we'll be speaking with Jules LaBelle, who has lost many legal battles, but still thinks that lost legal battles lead to great political victories. Stay with us.
Inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Everywhere is war. It's a war that until there are no longer first class and second class citizens of any nation, until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes. Miss a war that until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all without regard to race. It is a war. The dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain but a fleeting illusion to be pursued, but never attained. Now everywhere is war. War. And until the ignoble and unhappy regime that hold our brothers in Angola, in Mozambique, South Africa, subhuman bondage, have been toppled, totally destroyed.
Well, war. By Bob Marley here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In our studio, we are joined by Fernando Suarez del Solar, who lost his son Jesus in Iraq, believes he died as a result of a cluster bomb, although he was told that he was shot in combat. We're also joined by Medea Benjamin, who is the co-founder of Global Exchange, the human rights group based in San Francisco, who's been to Iraq many times and protested that war around the country here in the United States, has been arrested in Washington doing that, and has interrupted many a political official's statements with her protests. You went to Iraq for what reason, Medea, with this very special delegation of veterans and family members of those lost or fighting in Iraq?
Well, these family members have grave concerns about what's happening in Iraq and feel like they have more at stake than the general population. They wanted to go knowing the risks. One woman who has two children there drove twice along the most dangerous road in Iraq up to Tikrit to try to visit her daughter, who she hadn't seen in 3 years. These people want to know the truth, and they want to come home and lobby to get the troops back home. They feel, some of them feel proud their children helped overthrow Saddam Hussein. Some of them were against the war from the beginning. But they all feel that the job of policing Iraq is not an appropriate job for the U.S. military. It's time for them to come home.
You, Fernando, are wearing a pin that says, "Money for schools, not for war."
Yes, this one is the point. The war is no good for nobody. Nobody winning the wars. Everybody lost. And in America, there's no money right now for school, for education. A lot of teachers lost the job, but the money is going to the army. The recruiting is around the school. I understand the culture and military culture in America when the children need more school.
Where are you originally from? Where were you born?
I born in Mexico. And my son, too. All my family is from Mexico.
It's interesting. Your son was also born in Mexico. The first day that Al Jazeera had its English language website, I think one of the first reports on it was about the Green Card Army, about how many people, young men and women who were sent to Iraq, were actually born in other countries.
A lot of boys is the green card inside the military system. And this one is because the recruiting people is the target, is the Hispanic, are the minorities, ethnics.
The minorities and ethnics.
Yes.
And Fernando had a chance to talk to many Latinos in Iraq that he brought letters from U.S. children to both children in Iraq as well as to soldiers. And it was quite amazing to see the interactions between Fernando and the Latino soldiers, giving them these letters from the children, all with the message that we love you, we support you, we want you to come home.
And what was the response of the soldiers?
Some boys just cry and say, thank you. Thank you for helping me for the back home as soon as possible. And all boys, when I have a meeting in the street, in the checkpoints, and I explain what is the mission, what is the campaign, the bring the troops home now, and show the letters from the children. All, everybody, American and Hispanic, thank you. Thank you. We need back home.
And what overall was the feeling of the troops? I mean, did you find people felt it was right that the U.S. was there? Felt it was wrong of the troops you spoke to in Iraq?
The Iraqi people?
No, the U.S.
Oh, the U.S.
The soldiers. And then, yes, the Iraqi people.
And I talked with the boys and say, what are you feeling about here? What are you job here? And some boys say, I don't know. I don't know what I do here. The other boys say, oh, freedom the Iraqi people, but this one is finished. The Iraq people now is upset with the military. The first time is happy, but now is nobody's happy. And have a very nervous in the streets when they have a patrol. It's very nervous, the boy. You see the face is the children's, 19, 18 years, but the face is the very nervous because nobody like the military in the streets. And the Iraqi people, when I ask, say, I am fine because no more Saddam Hussein, but the Bush say we have a democracy, a freedom country. It's 8 months, and I don't have democracy here, and I don't have nothing here. I lost my job, I lost my family, and the military is in the street, and I can do nothing. Is the democracy in America? I don't want.
We're talking to Fernando Suarez del Solar. His son, Lance Corporal Jesus Suarez del Solar, was 20 years old when he was killed in Iraq. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Global Exchange, led this delegation to Iraq. How does Iraq compare now to the many other times that you have been there?
Well, Amy, perhaps I'm very naive, but I assumed that things would be better. We went to a school and a hospital the first day we were there, and we were all in shock. The pediatric hospital didn't have antibiotics. It didn't have basic equipment. It didn't have the right size IVs for the children. We all started to cry when they told us that things were better in the hospital under sanctions. And then we went to a school, and this was one of the many schools that Bechtel is supposed to improve. And the school,
San Francisco-based corporation,
yeah,
your hometown.
Yeah. The school had no books because they couldn't use the Saddam Hussein books, and they had no new books, so they were worse off. We said, do you have electricity? They said, well, first of all, the electricity goes on and off all the time, but secondly, we don't have light bulbs. They didn't have light bulbs, Amy. The windows were all broken. It was freezing now in the classrooms. They had no heaters. They had nothing.
Did you meet with L. Paul Bremer?
Yes, we met with Paul Bremer. You know, the U.S. didn't know what to do with this delegation. They tried to get us not to go. They said it was too dangerous. They couldn't guarantee our safety. They harassed people before leaving to make them feel that they would be arrested, that this was an illegal trip. Some of the people dropped out. We went anyway. Paul Bremer didn't want to meet with us. He was forced to meet with us because of the power of Fernando and the other families. And they didn't help us get to the bases. They didn't help us interact with the troops. We just did it anyway. And I just want to tell a quick story of the power of Fernando and this group. The first day we went to see a family whose son had been killed by the U.S. troops in, quote, an accident. We heard the terrible story. Fernando and the father cried together. The day after we left, a U.S. military commander went to the base, gave the family $10,000, and said they'd give him $3,000 a month, but please don't talk anymore to Americans or to the military or to the media. This delegation has a tremendous power, and we're going to use the power of the delegation, now that we're home, to lobby to get the money to the Iraqis that they deserve, to get the troops out of the streets, and to get them back home.
What about that meeting with L. Paul Bremer? What did he say? What did he say to you, Fernando? And at that point, did you know that your son was killed by a cluster bomb, and did you raise it with the U.S. overseer in Iraq?
With Mr. Bremen?
Yes.
No, Mr. Bremen is about the 3.5 minutes only meeting with the delegation, received the letter.
Three and a half minutes, and where did he meet you?
He say, I'm sorry, and I'm going to try to find the time for more big meeting with the delegation.
Did you actually go into his office?
We met with the Iraqi Governing Council, the president, and several other members. They were anxious to meet with us. When Paul Bremer found out we were meeting with the Iraqi leadership, then he felt obligated to meet with us.
And what did he say? What?
Well, he didn't say anything. It was all diplomatic. But the head of the Iraqi Governing Council, when we said, do you think the troops should leave? He said, yes. We said, when? He said, tomorrow. This is the Shiite who has the largest following of any member of the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council. And he told us he think it's a mistake that the troops are still there, that they should leave.
You're still wearing pink, Madia Benjamin. Is Code Pink still active, the feminist anti-war group?
Very active, and we're active in Iraq. We set up the Occupation Watch Center, which is the center that organized this amazing trip, and we continue to work against the war both here in the United States and with Iraqis, particularly Iraqi women.
And you're speaking tonight in New York? Both Fernando, you, and the whole group that went to Iraq?
Yes, the entire delegation with lots of footage from our trip will be at 7 p.m. at the Washington Square Church in New York City.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. Your thoughts upon your return, Fernando, we'll end with those.
Thank you.
If you'd like to share, as you return to New York now and the United States, your thoughts having made this trip to Iraq.
Yeah, we need to show the people, American people, this occupation is not good for everybody, and the American people need to push the government for finish and come back home, the troops, as soon as possible.
Thank you very much. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we take a little musical interlude. We'll talk with attorney Jules LaBelle, who's lost many court battles, but still feels that social change has been accomplished by those losses. And then Ralph Nader will join us on the phone as he travels the country, having set up an exploratory committee, deciding whether to run for president in 2004. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! Again, Ralph Nader coming up next. Reading from Success Without Victory, Lost Legal Battles on the Long Road to Justice in America. Winners and losers, success and failure, victory and defeat. American culture places an extremely high premium on success and firmly equates it with winning. In politics, sports, business, and the courtroom, we have a passion to win and are terrified of losing. Instead of viewing success and failure through such a rigid lens, Jules LaBelle suggests we move past the winner-take-all model and learn valuable lessons from legal and political activists who've advocated causes destined to lose in court, but have had important progressive and long-term effects on American society. Jules LaBelle joins us in the studio. His book, Success Without Victory. Running against the current of success is victory. Give us a brief historical sketch, Jules, about the lost legal battles that have led to great victories.
The first major campaign was the abolitionists, who challenged the fugitive slave laws in court as being unconstitutional and lost over and over again. Yet, in doing so, they helped mobilize Northern opinion against these laws and against the Northern cooperation with slavery. And eventually, a fellow like Salmon Chase, who was one of the great lawyers who represented these fugitive slaves, his briefs and his arguments became the bedrock platform of the Republican Party, which was successful politically. So that was one lost legal case that led to political success. Susan B. Anthony went to vote in Rochester in 1872, and she said the 14th Amendment should give me a right to vote. It's denying my equal treatment not to vote. And she was, for voting, she convinced the inspectors in Rochester to let her vote. And for this act of voting, she was criminally prosecuted under a law designed to ensnare Confederates who were illegally voting. They prosecuted and said Susan Anthony. And she used her case to reach hundreds of thousands of people around the country to show them how outrageous it was that women weren't being allowed to vote. And even though she lost in court because they denied her a jury trial, her case was one of the important cases spurring the women's rights movement and the women's suffrage movement throughout the country in the 1870s and 1880s. Another case was plant closing activists. In Youngstown, workers who were being let go by U.S. Steel when they were closing their plants, and Youngstown, Ohio, was the second leading steel maker in this country. Today it makes no steel. When I moved to Pittsburgh, it had 55,000 steel workers, U.S. steel workers, throughout the Mon Valley. Today, they're less than 5,000. But the workers didn't take this lying down. They sat in, they challenged what U.S. Steel was doing, and they went to court. And they got, as their attorneys, Thornton Lind, Ramsey Clark, the former Attorney General of the United States, Arthur Kanoy from the Center for Constitutional Rights. And even though they lost in court, their battle spurred many, many other battles to challenge this plant closing and moving plants from the what was known as the Rust Belt to the South and to overseas. The Center for Constitutional Rights waged a long campaign against intervention in Central America. And even though that campaign was unsuccessful in courts, I think the center, whose basic philosophy is that you use the law not simply to win courtroom victories but to spur social movements, helped in creating an environment in this country against those interventions in Central America.
How many court cases have you lost?
Oh, I probably am in the Guinness Book of World Records, if there is such a entry, for the longest losing streak. I'd say about 10 or 15 cases. I recently brought a case which no one would take because it was such a hopeless case, challenging a Supermax prison in Ohio, and we won. And we're now on appeal. I didn't know what to make of it because it was so out of character.
So would you consider that a loss, having won?
Yeah, I didn't. As I said, it totally perplexed me. I was totally confused by this courtroom victory.
But the victory was what?
The victory was in a case involving these Supermax prisons, which are awful situations where you keep people in long-term, 3, 4, 5 years, sometimes for their life, in small cells where they spend virtually 24 hours a day in isolation. And many of these people are put in without any due process. without any idea that the state has to prove that they did anything. And we won a victory saying that they couldn't put these people in jail, in this kind of supermax prison, without first giving them a hearing and proving that they actually did something to deserve being put into this place.
Because what is the supermax prison like?
It's 24 hours lockup isolation in a cell as large as a parking space, where you don't have, in this supermax, you never go outside, you don't breathe fresh air, you don't have outdoor recreation, you don't have almost any other contact with any human being. If you can imagine being in a prison where for 4, 5, 6 years you have no contact with any other human being, that's what it's like.
What about your cases around war? Jules LaBelle is our guest, professor of international constitutional law at the University of Pittsburgh Law School, also vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Well, we challenged the first Persian Gulf War. I represented Congressman Dellums and 55 other members of Congress. And Congressman Dellums brought that suit because he felt something had to be done to stop the rush to war in that case. And he felt that Bush was going to war without the approval of Congress. And, you know, we had a press conference when that case was filed, and all the reporters wanted to know about was, did you have any snowball's chance in hell of winning? That's all they want. That was their main interest. And Dellum said to them, that's an incredibly cynical question, because if you don't act, if you don't do anything, you'll never win. You'll never get anywhere. We brought this case, and the court held that the president couldn't go to war on his own. But then at the very end of the opinion, he said the situation wasn't ripe. He had to come back a couple of days before the war started. This was in December. The war started in January. So we were prepared to go back in January. But because of all the pressure building on Bush, including our lawsuit, Bush finally went to Congress. And as you probably know, he got the narrow approval in the Senate to go to war. And that mooted out our case. But we felt, even though we hadn't gotten the injunction that we sought, the case had been a political victory in that it had helped create an environment which forced Bush to go to the Congress.
And what about now? Last question. The current invasion. Any legal actions currently?
As of right now, there are no legal actions, although I think we're always trying to see if people want to, soldiers particularly, want to challenge this war. Now one of our big cases is challenging the situation in Guantanamo, which, again, we lost in the district court and lost in the Court of Appeals. Now the case is before the Supreme Court. But that case has, even though it lost in the lower courts, has kept the outrageous situation in Guantanamo, where these people are being kept with no due process, no legal process whatsoever. It has kept it before the country and the world for almost 2 years. So even though we lost in court, again, we think we're being successful in publicizing what is, again, a clear violation, I think, of both the constitutional law and the Geneva Conventions.
When will the Supreme Court hear the case?
The Supreme Court's going to hear it sometime in the early spring. And we hope for victory, but whether we win or lose in court, I think we'll have achieved our purposes.
Jules LaBelle, I want to thank you for being with us. Jules LaBelle is author of Success Without Victory, Lost Legal Battles and the Long Road to Justice in America. He is the vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. When we return, Ralph Nader joins us. Will he run? Should he run? Stay with us. Thank you. John Fahey here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The New York Times is reporting today President Bush's political advisors are now all but certain Howard Dean will be the Democratic presidential nominee and are planning a campaign that takes account of what they see as Dean's strengths and weaknesses. This comes a day after the nine Democratic presidential candidates debated each other in New Hampshire, where the first primary takes place on January 27th. Also yesterday, Democrat Gavin Newsom narrowly beat Green Party candidate Matt Gonzalez in San Francisco's mayoral race. If Gonzalez had won, he would have become the nation's highest-ranking Green Party member. Today, we're joined on the telephone by 2000 Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader. Last week, he authorized the formation of a new presidential exploratory committee, which could mark his first step in another bid for the presidency. Debate has already begun among Green and Democrats over what role, if any, Ralph Nader should take in 2004. Before we speak to Ralph Nader, we're going to turn to a speech he gave at the National Conference on Media Reform in Madison, Wisconsin. Well, actually, not the speech, but the question and answer period. After he gave a major address on media issues, a member of the audience stood up, said he was a supporter of Ralph Nader, but begged him not to run again. This was Ralph Nader's response.
I would say this gentleman is a civil liberties champion, correct? Have you ever told anyone not to speak?
No, sir.
Okay. Political speech involves running for office. It is one of the most preferred uses of the First Amendment. You can challenge, rebut, argue. Please never tell any candidate not to speak.
And that was Ralph Nader's response. He joins us on the line now from Princeton, New Jersey, as he travels the country meeting with small and large groups, talking to people about what they think he should do, whether he should run for president in 2004. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ralph Nader.
Good morning, Amy.
Well, your thoughts today. Where do you stand right now as we hear that the Bush administration thinks it's going to be Howard Dean? They're preparing. ABC News, the latest report is from Dennis Kucinich that they've pulled their reporters from the Kucinich, Braun, and Sharpton campaigns, and Kucinich is fiercely objecting. You had a front row seat at the New Hampshire Democratic debate the other night. Your thoughts. What are you going to do?
Well, on the debate, it's quite clear that Dennis Kucinich did extraordinarily well. I think he shined in the context of his challengers, and I think it's a very unwise move for the reporters to be pulled from the campaign of his initiative, as well as Mosley Braun and Al Sharpton. I think the importance of preserving the attempt to defend the civil liberties of third parties and independent candidates is independently sufficient reason for third parties and independent candidates to run. They're being squeezed out by ballot access hurdles, by exclusion from debates, by all kinds of barriers. And historically, third parties, independent candidates have been the seeds of regeneration. Of major parties. They have pushed the agenda on a whole host of issues in the 19th and 20th century, and they've got to be exercised. It's really exercising democracy's muscle. Having said that, I'm watching quite carefully the quality of the agenda that the Democratic candidates are pushing. I've sent a 25-page agenda to both the Democratic and Republican National Committees in late October, and I hope that sometime this month they will reply. Both committees have indicated they're going to reply, so we can see where they stand on a whole range of democracy-stretching issues, from living wage to energy conversion to the empowerment of people to be able to join together more easily as consumers and workers and small taxpayers and communities. So I'm in an exploratory stage right now, and that's a legal term under the Federal Election Commission. We have a website, NaderExplore04.org, and I'm engaged in testing the waters. That's another legal phrase, Amy. concerning a presidential run, and I'll decide sometime early next year.
Yesterday, when I said we were going to talk to you today, a lot of people wrote in expressing their opinions. I'll read two of them. One says, I think he should not go near the presidential election in 2004. I voted for him in 2000, regret that choice. The first priority right now is to get Bush out. All other matters take a back seat. I think the Democratic Party is moving to the left again after getting the message loud and clear from the people who voted for Nader in 2000. Without Nader in 2000, we would have Lieberman as the Democratic hopeful instead of Dean, and the party would not have changed. The Dems are slow to change, but they're changing. In 2008, I'll vote for Nader again, but in 2004, we need to get Bush out. Another person who wrote in said, run, Ralph, run. The Demopublicans have done everything Ralph said they would do. They have helped him push the war in Iraq, Patriot Act, Medicare, Deform Bill, etc., etc. Two different opinions. Your response?
Well, first of all, the Democrats who think like the first person you just quoted have a problem. Privately or publicly, when you say, did Gore win the election in Florida? Did he win the election nationally? And they'll say yes. And yet when they're asked about a Green Party campaign or an Independent Party campaign or whatever, they in effect cite 2000 as if Gore would have won if the Greens were not on the ballot. Well, I think Gore did win in Florida. I think he won around the country. And so let's not make 2000 a case for not speaking out and pushing the agenda and involving young people and all the other things that the Green Party wants to do. It is true the rhetoric of the Democrats on the debates seems to be more liberal or progressive. That is, even the front runners. You've got Lieberman talking about corporations paying their fair share of taxes. You've got Dean saying again and again the people have to organize to do this, that the candidate is not going to be able to do it without the people organizing and so on. But that's still at the rhetoric stage. In terms of the rhetoric, in terms of the record of the Democratic Party, only one senator opposed the Patriot Act, Senator Feingold. They helped Bush push through the war resolution for an unconstitutional delegation of war-declaring power to the presidency. Rhetorically, the Democrats in Congress opposed the massive tax cuts for the wealthy and the diversion of budgets away from necessities of the American people, even though they could have stopped both of those tax cuts. So we're dealing here with a party that's still a corporate Democrat party. And I think Dean is going to have, if he becomes the nominee, he's going to have a very tough time translating his rhetoric into a record of performance, given the corporate influence that's still very powerful inside the Democratic Party.
What do you say to those, like was raised with you in your meeting with folks in Vermont? While some support you, others who are involved in independent progressive politics say you could hurt their chances, that there would be a backlash, an anger that you were running, and so they in lower levels of government office could lose as well.
Well, I don't know how that works out. I mean, there are schools of thought within the Green Party. Some don't want a presidential run. That's a small minority. Some want a presidential run, but not in the close states. And some want an all-out presidential run. I do agree that the future of the Green Party has to start with local and state candidates. They won about 25% of their local seats in 2002 and 2003 that they contested. What they have to do is contest more seats, of course. But it's shown that at the Board of Education, Development Authority, City Council, so on, they can win. But what's needed is a broader vision for multi-party politics in this country. The two parties demonstrate towering similarities that are way, way larger than the differences that the Democrats are willing to contest over. The convergence process indentured to the same financial interests that fund both parties continues unabated. So I think a case could be made, however provocative, that the Democrats don't know how to defeat Bush because they are so cautious and they are so withdrawn and so indentured to the same financial interests that they need other progressive initiatives to open up other fronts and open up other issues that if the Democrats were smart, they could pick up on.
Would you put Howard Dean in that category?
Yes, I would. I think, for example, that the Bush administration is far more vulnerable politically than the Democrats are probing or exposing. I refer people to essential.org, which has my letter to George W. Bush from a month and a half ago about the Texas State Republican Party platform of 2002, which has 25 positions diametrically opposed to the Bush administration. It's basically the platform of the conservative libertarian Republicans who are furious all through the South, including other states, with the Bush administration on the Patriot Act, the invasion of privacy, erosion of civil liberties, NAFTA, GATT, the huge deficit, the corporate welfare subsidies. It's surprising the Democrats are not probing a wedge there that would depress Bush's vote. But there are a lot of ways to depress Bush's vote that the Democrats have to be educated on.
Howard Dean says that the U.S. troops should stay in Iraq, although he opposed the invasion, he said. Dennis Kucinich's message was U.S. out, U.N. in. What is your position?
Well, I think Dennis makes a good point. He said you can't be against the war and be for the military occupation, which is still involved in the war. And I think a U.N. trusteeship, which is a well-established concept in U.N. History, is the way to go, especially given the fact that Iraq has a potential of ripping itself apart in terms of the various ethnic and religious groups that are there. But a UN trusteeship with a rapid transition, I think, is the way to go there.
Are you going to run, Ralph Nader?
I'm going to decide that, Amy, early next year. I'm really testing the waters now. We have this website up, naderexplore04.org. There has to be some preliminary indication that we're going to have people in the various states. There's a big ballot access problem that has to be overcome. But we're in the process of testing the waters.
And what is the sense from the meetings that you're having around the country?
There's a diversity of opinion there. There's some people who are very frightened about a possible second administration in the, headed by Bush. There are some people that think that there needs to be building for the future. You can't simply sit out the progressive agenda on a four-year cycle because
we have 5 seconds.
It's never the right time, you know.
Well,
and then there are people who say there should be a full-fledged run.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. Ralph Nader speaking to us from Princeton, New Jersey, where he is engaged in exploring whether he will run for president. And that does it for the show. If you'd like to get a copy, call 1-800-881-2359. Our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Pervez Sharma, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.